By 7:30, Prince's C Company Rangers had slithered the last quarter mile to Highway 5 and were resting in a shallow, brushy ditch directly across the road from the padlocked gate. They'd been in attack position for more than a half hour. Now they only had to remain silent and wait for Murphy's men to ignite the fireworks. The fence was close enough so that the Rangers could see the individual barbs on the individual strands of wire, and, rising beyond, the shaggy, forlorn rooftops of the prisoner barracks. The men grasped their weapons with the barrels resting in the weeds, just inches below the level of the road. Highway 5 still held the day's heat, a narrow strip of cooked asphalt half ruined by neglect and by war, the surface rubbled with potholes and forced open by thistles. Realizing the Japanese convoys had jammed this same stretch of highway just 12 hours earlier, Captain Prince was heartened to see that it now appeared empty in both directions. He trusted that it would stay that way, that the two guerrilla groups had safely reached their destinations and were ready to destroy whatever trouble should come. The Black Widow receded into the night, and in its void the men could hear the Japanese guards talking excitedly among themselves. The plane had clearly riled them, and judging by their desperate, scattershot speech, they seemed worried and confused. At one point, a sentry stationed in the front tower got a strong whiff of something suspicious. He leaned out the window and restlessly scoured the field. "He was squinting and sniffing and looking down at us," recalled Vance Shears. "I think he near about ruptured his eyeballs trying to see us. Luckily, it was too dark. He knew there was something wrong, but he didn't know exactly what." Captain Prince eyed his glow-in-the-dark watch. 7:40. Where was F Company? He wondered. They should be in position by now. At any moment, he expected Murph's gunfire to erupt. The minutes dripped by. The men kept still as mannequins, pressed low against the ditch wall, facing the gates of Cabanatuan. Their nerves flitted and raced. They imagined that every noise was trebled, that the Japanese could hear the sound of their dripping sweat, their chattering teeth, the train of their own thoughts. Fingers hooked around triggers, muzzles fell on shadowy forms within. "We felt like they could hear us breathing," Roy Peters said. "They were just 30 feet away. We sat in the dark, listening to them talk and talk, wondering which of them would be the first to die." An hour earlier, most of the men of Cabanatuan were squatting outside their barracks in their G-strings and burlap rags, sucking the runts of old cigarettes, enjoying the stillness of the gathering twilight. Evening chow was over, and the mess hall details were busy rinsing out the cauldrons, scraping the charred rice from the bottoms of pots. In the medical wards, several hundred men lay on the hard tatami mats, coughing sclerotic coughs, brushing away flies with languid sweeps of their hands. The Japanese could be heard across the way, frantically moving vehicles about, hoisting burlap sacks and stacking crates of supplies. In the late afternoon, 3 light tanks, along with 2 new platoons of Japanese soldiers, had been seen slipping into the camp. The smells of salty fish and simmering miso tendrilled through the barbed wire fence. To the northeast, a loose constellation of campfires speckled the scrubby margins of the Kabu River. A few minutes later, an airplane shot across the sky. It seemed to have appeared out of nowhere, as though a trap door had opened in the firmament. As the aircraft streaked low over the camp, Tommy Thomas caught a momentary glimpse of the twin-tailed contraption. It was black, futuristic, sleeker than any plane Thomas had seen before. He observed that the guards up in the tower were apoplectic, hurling themselves upon the floorboards. The plane flew exceedingly low, low enough so that A.B. Abraham thought he could easily hit it with a rock. All about the camp, the prisoners stared up in awe, wondering what the strange ship had in mind for them. The plane looked so different from anything else they'd seen that at first they thought it was German, or possibly Russian. Other prisoners described it as a black barn swallow, a War of the Worlds rocket, and an angel of death. To the men of Cabanatuan, the plane, whatever it was, seemed a powerful, almost eerie emblem of how far American technology had evolved in the 3 years of their captivity. Mechanically, logistically, conceptually, this was a different army. On Bataan, they'd starved in their shallow metal helmets, fighting old-fashioned pitched battles with dud shells and rusty artillery. 30-odd months later, they had only to gaze upon this sci-fi lozenge streaking through the clouds at 300 miles per hour to understand that everything, the whole social and industrial universe back home, had changed. It was as though they were looking at a new country, a new era. As night fell upon Nueva Ecija, the airplane vanished and the camp seemed preternaturally quiet and dark. Except for a few flickering coconut oil lamps lighting up the interiors of the medical wards, the grounds were thoroughly blacked out, in accordance with the standing Japanese policy to prevent air raids. At approximately 7:45, Dr. Hibbs was sitting on the steps of the American headquarters, enjoying a postprandial seminar on the stars with three close friends. Tommy Thomas was smoking a cigarette and conversing with the camp tailor outside the last building on the south end of the compound, only 30 feet from the Japanese fence. Medic Ralph Rodriguez was working at his typewriter in the medical office and playing records on a rickety phonograph that had arrived 2 years earlier in a Red Cross package. "We only had a couple of records, so we just played them over and over again," Rodriguez said. He put on an extremely groove-worn version of the old Tin Pan Alley song, "Wait Till the Sun Shines, Nelly," and stared out the window. The vapid tune seeped through the camp. Then she heard him softly say, "Wait till the sun shines, Nelly, and the clouds go drifting by. We will be happy, Nelly, don't you cry." A few seconds later, the scratchy melody was overwhelmed by a fusillade of gunfire erupting from the rear of the camp. Rodriguez could hear the screams of men, could see the traceries against the night sky. Bullets chewed through the NEPA thatching and drilled into the far wall. The song wouldn't shut up. Through the window pane, she looked at the rain. A squall of mortars, machine guns staccato. On instinct, prisoners everywhere hurled themselves into latrines, crawled under their barracks, burrowed into anything that felt like a hole. Dr. Hibbs dove into an irrigation ditch and listened to the sound, as Hibbs put it, of whistling slugs, Roman candles, and flaming meteors sailing over our heads. A.B. Abraham heard his buddies desperately conferring in their barracks, "Mother, oh mother, what a way to die!" Abraham's first instinct was to defend himself. "They won't get me," he thought, "not without a fight." Abraham crept under his barracks and retrieved a long, knotted club that he'd buried beneath the floorboards weeks earlier. He returned to his bunk wielding the club, vowing to bludgeon the first Japanese executioner who ventured through the door. In the kitchen, where a POW named John Cook had just finished up the dishes, the hanging stockpots rattled and clinked in the relentless spatter of lead. A few seconds later, he heard the rupture of a grenade, then another. Rodriguez hurled himself on the floor of his office. "Ralph, shut that fucking thing off!" "Must we stay home, Joe?" she cried. "I said shut it off, goddammit!" "The bullets were thick as swarms of bees," one POW said, "and flying so close I could feel their heat on my bare skin." On the south end of camp, Tommy Thomas rolled into a drainage ditch, his heart thudding in his chest. "I heard screaming and moaning all around us," he said, "and I thought the Japs were finally massacring us." Crouched on the floor, Rodriguez reached over and shook the leg of the table, but the phonograph wouldn't stop. "Maybe we better not wander. Maybe we better not roam." If the slaughter could have been viewed without sound, one might have been disposed to call it beautiful. In an instant, the entire fence line lit up in a corona of frenetic glitters, soon numbering in the thousands, each burst crisp and discreet against the black night. The orange flashes came in pleasingly random and inscrutable patterns, like the semaphore of fireflies in a dense forest. Occasionally, gold stars streaked across the field and ended abruptly in warm blooms of yellow and vermilion, leaving the sky crisscrossed with trails of smoke. Yet the sounds, shrill and fulminant, were at odds with the majestic visuals. Splintering bamboo, the whine of stray slugs, glass fracturing into shards, sputters of pulverized dirt. The blunt sound bullets make when they enter flesh, sending up aerosol clouds of blood. Polyrhythmic jackhammerings and ricochets of BARs, of carbines, of M1s and Tommy guns. the bilious rip of fragmentation grenades, of anti-tank missiles piercing metal, of walls riven apart. Once the crack of Murphy's rifle rang out, the vast fusillade was unleashed from one end of the compound to the other. Within 15 seconds, all the towers and pillboxes had been neutralized or obliterated altogether. The Japanese were unable to reply. The surprise was so complete, the firepower so massive and omnidirectional, that the enemy was left paralyzed. Hunkered along the front road, Prince's C Company opened fire with a barrage that was so immense it was plainly overkill. As one ranger described it, "We mowed them down like hay." Since there were only a few visible human targets at which the waiting rangers could aim their rifles, they lavished those targets with absurd amounts of fire. The sentry in the front pillbox was riddled with so many bullets that his head and upper body atomized, as one ranger put it. A guard in the northeast tower was ripped completely in half at the waist. The torso dropped over the ledge of the guardhouse window and landed with a sodden bounce, smoke rising off the flesh. In the midst of this lashing gunfire, a C Company ranger named Teddy Richardson leaped up from the ditch, bounded across the road, and tried to bash open the padlock on the gate with the butt of his Tommy gun. This proved impractical, so he fished out a .45 automatic pistol from his side holster with the intention of blasting the lock open. Just as he drew this weapon, however, a Japanese guard from within the compound managed to raise his rifle and fire at Richardson. Judging by the muzzle flame, the assailant appeared to be only 30 feet from the gate. Incredibly, the bullet missed Richardson, but glanced his pistol with sufficient force to jar it from his hand. He responded impulsively, squeezing off a few rounds from his Tommy gun in the general direction of the guard, who was never heard from again. Then Richardson retrieved his pistol from the ground and resumed what he'd been doing before this unpleasant distraction. With a single shot, the padlock clicked open. Richardson flung the lock to the side, pulled back the hasp, and threw open the ponderous gates of Cabanatuan. Now all the rangers jumped up from the ditch and poured through the breached gate, scurrying to their assigned positions inside. The next ranger who entered Cabanatuan after Richardson was a BAR man from Minnesota named Leland Provencher. As Richardson and Provencher dashed past the guardhouse area, they encountered a dim form standing in the pathway. "What's going on here?" the man yelled in an odd accent. Richardson and Provencher assumed this person must be an American prisoner, so they lowered their weapons. Then the figure wheeled about and took off toward the enemy quarters, yelling frantically in Japanese. Realizing it was a ruse, the two rangers opened fire and dropped the imposter in his tracks. Following the camp's central thoroughfare, Provencher and several others raced back to the Japanese office quarters and raked the buildings for several uninterrupted minutes. Provencher's heavy rifle was set to automatic, so that he only had to depress once, brrrt, and the flimsy Nipa barracks were chewed to pieces at a rate of 550 rounds per minute. He heard screams and groans inside, but didn't see the enemy. Encountering no resistance whatsoever, Provencher moved on to what appeared to be a utility shed. He raised his rifle and started to fire when he heard a voice cry out, "Don't shoot, please, I'm an American." Given what had happened at the front gate, Provencher was skeptical, but for some reason he held his fire. The man turned out to be an American after all, a Navy engineer whom the Japanese had impressed into doing maintenance work on the generator that powered the camp lights. Provencher came within a beat of killing him. "I don't know what the hell saved him, because it was only by pure instinct that I didn't shoot," Provencher said. "I had my gun on him. It was just a matter of pulling the trigger." Provencher ordered him to come out very slowly so the rangers could examine him carefully. With mincing steps, the man emerged from the maintenance shed holding up an old Life magazine he'd just been reading that was now lanced with a fresh bullet hole. "Get to the main gate," Provencher cried as gently as he could under the circumstances. The prisoner, still blanched with fright, stumbled nervously in serpentine fashion toward the front of the compound. While the rifleman maintained a constant wall of fire, a bazooka team, led by a staff sergeant from Texas named Manton Stewart, sprinted farther down the same central road and came to a halt directly across from the corrugated sheds that Bill Nellist had spotted earlier in the day. They were so far back in the compound that they could clearly see the muzzle flashes of F Company as they riddled the rear barracks. Stuart crouched in the gravel and hoisted an ungainly steel pipe to his shoulder. Another ranger inserted a finned 3.5-pound rocket into the rear of the smoothbore tube and wrapped Stuart on the arm when it was loaded. Stuart swiveled the launcher in the direction of the sheds and was about to mash the trigger when he detected a movement in his peripheral vision. A long bed truck, packed with Imperial Army soldiers, was chuffing beside the shed. The driver had just switched on the ignition and was desperately pulling out, evidently with the intention of fleeing the camp while there was still a chance. Stuart squeezed the trigger, which ignited the electric fuse, and in a bright, steady arc, the self-propelled rocket fizzed across the compound, striking the body of the truck and piercing its engine block. Within seconds, the vehicle had been reduced to a pyre of exploding fuel, shattered glass, and melted rubber. Several dozen injured men, some of whom had been set aflame, crawled half alive from the carcass of the truck, only to be finished off by Ranger gunfire. They were pitifully easy targets, clearly silhouetted in the flames. Then Stuart turned back to his original target, the galvanized metal sheds that were believed to house Japanese tanks. It was imperative that he attack the garages before the Japanese had a chance to start up their tanks and put them to deadly use. With several bursts, Stuart's bazooka was able to puncture and destroy the thin-skinned buildings and whatever vehicles were stowed inside. The structures warped and yawed in the billowing flames before collapsing into mangled heaps. Better able to see in the waxing light of the fires, several of the Rangers thought they glimpsed tanks. Stuart fired in that direction, and by most accounts scored a direct hit. No longer having to concern themselves with the specter of tanks raging through camp, C Company could now turn to the most satisfying aspect of the evening's work, storming the Bastille. A group of Rangers ran toward the American section of the compound, brandishing wire cutters. A Ranger named Lester Malone ran up to the main American gate and inspected the lock. He took two steps back and fired his M1. Then Malone yanked off the lock and opened up the gates to the American prison. "We're Yanks," he yelled. "This is a prison break. Head for the main gate." At first, the prisoners failed to understand. They were too mentally brittle to process the chaos. Fearing the worst, they took refuge in the barest and most pitiful of hiding places. To one Ranger, who had sliced his way through the fence with wire cutters, the inmates of Cabanatuan looked like scared vermin scattering for cover after you switch on the kitchen lights. They huddled in corners, cowered in black water ditches, lurked behind frail bamboo posts, praying for a slimness that even they could not affect. Some were literally scurrying from their deliverers. At least one prisoner wet himself. Still others were praying and running around in circles, as A.B. Abraham recalled, because they didn't know where to run to. Ranger Alvy Robbins almost bayoneted one of the terrified prisoners who sprinted around the corner of a NEPA building and surprised him. "I didn't recognize him as being American," said Robbins. "I thought he could have been Japanese. The adrenaline was flowing. The battle was raging. It was dark outside. I raised my rifle and came within an instant of running that bayonet right through him." To the prisoners, the scene didn't make sense. There were troops running from barracks to barracks, dim forms crouched along the camp's dirt pathways. They were gesturing wildly, shouting orders. "Buddy, you're free," a voice said. "Up quick and get over to the gate. You're a soldier again." Like many others, Bert Bank was convinced it was a trick. He felt sure the Japanese were using English to lure the Americans outside so the executioners could more conveniently gun down their victims. "We whispered to each other not to move, that it was a trap to get us to run, and then the Japanese would open up on us." Bank was lying on the ground, trying to persuade his buddies not to acquiesce in this enemy scheme, when a Ranger walked right up to him and tugged him on the arm. "Come on, we're here to save you," he said. "Run for the gate." Bank still wouldn't budge. The Ranger looked into his eyes and saw they were vacant, registering nothing. "What's wrong with you?" he asked. "Don't you want to be free?" A smile formed on Banks's lips. Something in the Ranger's accent had reached him. "Where you from, boy?" he asked. "Oklahoma," replied the Ranger. Bank tendered his hand.
Oklahoma's good enough for me. Say, give me a lift here. I can't see a thing.
For prisoners who could see, the Rangers looked exceedingly strange. They wore unfamiliar uniforms, carried unfamiliar guns. To starved men, the strapping soldiers looked impossibly huge, even menacing. Ralph Rodriguez was thoroughly frightened by the first Ranger he encountered. This guy looked like a giant. I thought, what kind of a man is this? He had guns everywhere, big hands. He could have been a man from Mars. He yelled out, "Any more Americans?" I was trembling when I raised my hand. "Here." Even when the fear of a massacre had passed, even when most of the prisoners understood that the Rangers were Americans come to liberate them, many were still curiously reluctant to go. They seemed suspicious of their good fortune. They couldn't shed the dour pessimism of captivity long enough to understand that captivity was over. Or perhaps on some half-conscious level, they still found it hard to transgress the order of the Japanese, the only authority they'd known for 3 years. Some of the POWs appeared almost ungrateful at first. John Cook, wearing only a G-string and high-top leather shoes, practically interrogated his liberator. I said, "Hey, who in the hell are you?" The guy had the funniest uniform on, with a funny-looking cap, and he was carrying something that looked like a grease gun, like he was going to grease up a car. He said, "We're Yanks. Get your ass out the main gate." This guy's trying to save my life, and I'm sitting there carrying on an argument with him. I said, "No Yank ever wore a uniform like that." He said, "The hell we don't." As the precious minutes ticked by, the Rangers became more and more irritated by the strange stubbornness of the POWs. They didn't seem to understand the urgency of the situation. "I was getting annoyed," recalled Alvy Robbins. "I'd say to them, 'Listen, I got a job to do here. I can't spend a lot of time arguing with you. There's thousands of Japanese just up the road. We got to get out of here in a hurry.'" In some cases, the Rangers actually had to use physical force. "We just turned them around and booted them," said Lester Malone. "We couldn't fool around and explain nothing. They just didn't want to believe we were Americans." One of the prisoners Malone booted was Herbert Ott, the camp veterinarian. I told him, "Get the hell out of here." I just turned him toward the gate and kicked him on out. Dr. Ralph Hibbs was another prisoner who needed a little physical convincing. "What the hell is going on?" Hibbs shouted at three Rangers who came bounding down the path toward him with their Tommy guns blazing from their hips. "Where'd you come from? Are you guerrillas?"
"We're Rangers, General Kruger's boys."
"What are Rangers?" Hibbs demanded. He was taxing their patience. Finally, one of them picked up the doctor, muscled him around, and gave him a 10-foot kick squarely in the ass. The most recalcitrant prisoner of all was Hibbs's immediate superior, Colonel Duckworth, the American commander of Cabanatuan. Duckworth was digging in his heels, refusing to go, even refusing to let the Rangers escort others out. The colonel, who'd been suddenly awakened by the shooting and still seemed perplexed by the whole fracas, was strutting through the compound, buttonholing Rangers and shouting in their faces. He seemed unwilling to surrender authority to people whose identities and motives had been inadequately explained to him. Alvy Robbins was almost shocked by Duckworth's belligerence. He says,
"I'm Colonel Duckworth, and I'm in charge here. Who the hell are you?"
I said, "We're Americans. We've come for you."
He said, "You can't do this. You're going to get us killed. The Japanese told us no escapes. No one leaves here until I say they do."
I said, "You go see Captain Prince," and I went on about my business. Duckworth continued storming about the camp, demanding explanations, imploring the raiders to cease and desist. Finally, another Ranger grabbed him by the arm and said, "With all due respect, you are not in charge here. General MacArthur is. Now I suggest you head to the main gate before we kick your ass there. I'll apologize in the morning." Still grousing about the situation, Duckworth shambled out the American gate. Plagued by night blindness, like so many others, he promptly fell into a ditch and fractured his right arm. Slowly, the awareness that this was a jailbreak was beginning to sink in among the rest of the prisoners. They were reacting with a kind of catatonic ecstasy, numb and inarticulate. One prisoner wrapped his arms around the neck of the first Ranger he saw and kissed him on the forehead. All he could say was, "Oh boy, oh boy, oh boy." Alvy Robbins found one prisoner muttering in a darkened corner of one of the barracks, tears coursing down his face. "I thought we'd been forgotten," the prisoner said. "No, you're not forgotten," Robin said. We've come for you. Abe Abraham, still clutching his bludgeon, spotted a ranger with a Tommy gun sprinting for his barracks. The ranger poked his head through the open doorway and, discerning Abraham's dim outline inside, asked, "Can you walk, Mac?"
"Yeah, I can walk," Abraham replied. "I walked out of Bataan, and by God, I can walk out of here."
Now several rangers leaped into the barracks to assist anyone who needed a hand. Abraham spied a friend of his, a civilian from Norway named Axel Svensson, lying in a heap on the floor of the barracks. Under his breath, Svensson pleaded, "Please don't hurt me. I'm Norwegian. Please help me, God." The ranger was taken aback at the thought that he'd caused such trepidation. "I'm not God," he said. "Now come on, buddy, let's go." "Please don't kill me," Svensson still didn't understand. Abraham intervened, gently taking Svensson by the arm.
"Axel, it's okay," he said. "It's Abe, your friend. It's okay."
The rangers had forgotten, or never knew in the first place, that the Kabanatuan camp held men from other nationalities. Norwegians, Canadians, Dutch, and the largest non-American contingent of all, British. A ranger cried out, "You're free! All Americans assemble at the main gate!" To which one of the proper English prisoners yelled gleefully, "I'm not American, but shall I come too?" Outside Abraham's barracks, the exodus was proceeding in a more orderly fashion. Every prisoner who could walk was emerging from his crawl space or cubbyhole and moving toward the front. Tommy Thomas and his friend the camp tailor pulled themselves up from the ditch where they'd been hiding since the shooting started. The tailor couldn't walk very well, so he jumped on Thomas's back, and they bounced awkwardly down Broadway as fast as Thomas's huge, shambling frame could go. "We moved, and we moved fast," said Thomas. "We kept our heads down and headed for the main gate." Finally, they encountered one of the rangers leading prisoners out by the arm. "Are you a Yank?" Thomas asked. And when the ranger said he was, Thomas extended his hand and said, "Put her there." "I was glad it was dark so he couldn't see my tears," Thomas recalled. "I said, 'Are we ever happy to see you?'" "Here," said the ranger, "let us carry your buddy." All of this time, the shooting had continued, first in a merciless storm, now in sporadic coughs and splutters. As the prisoners made their way to the gate, they had to pick their way through several Japanese corpses, with stray bullets pinging this way and that. On his way out, John McCarty saw a couple of Japanese guards cut down by the ranger fire. "What a sight it was watching those soldiers fall," he said. "Some of them were so near to me that I could see the puffs on the front of their uniforms." Many of the POWs had belongings they wanted to fetch. Documents, medals, souvenirs, clean uniforms they had planned to wear out of camp when and if the glorious day came. They yearned to walk out of there with dignity. All about the camp, hidden in floorboards and thatched roofs, the men had stashed their little mementos and sentimental valuables for safekeeping, hoping to drag them out on Liberation Day. But now that the hour of freedom was upon them, they had no time to retrieve their valuables. Every time a prisoner ran back to the barracks to rescue some cherished item, a ranger would have to block his path and show him the way out. Even though they'd prepared themselves for the worst, the rangers were truly appalled at the grotesque condition of many of the prisoners. A nearly full moon had just risen over the Sierra Madre, flooding the countryside and making it possible for the rangers to get a vivid look at the men they were liberating. It was a ghostly parade. Amputees, consumptives, men with peg legs, men without hair or teeth, men with the elephantine appendages and scrotums indicative of wet beriberi. One ranger described them as sickly old birds that had just been plucked. The half-naked prisoners were dull-eyed and louse-infested, and they seemed old beyond their years. Most were barefoot, or they hobbled around on homemade sandals fashioned from string and slats of cardboard. Their hair was greasy and raggedly shorn close to the scalp with blunt knives. Lesions and battle scars marred their skin, and many had tropical ulcers as big as dinner plates. Some of the rangers welled with tears at the hideous procession and tried to offer comfort. "They tucked our men under their arms like babies," said Ralph Hibbs. "They shook their heads in disbelief and cried at the sight of these emaciated countrymen so far down the starvation trail." As soon as the captives began pouring out the front, Dr. Jimmy Fisher and his medics sprang up from their trench along Highway 5 and positioned themselves at the gate to assist the sickest ones. Scores of the prisoners, particularly those quartered in the medical wards, were completely immobile. The Rangers had to pick them up in their arms and carry them out the gate. "They were skin and bones," said Robert Anderson. "You could reach around their calves with your thumb and forefinger." The POWs were light enough so that some Rangers were able to carry two prisoners on their back at once. "With some of them," said Lester Malone, "it was just like you were carrying a 10-year-old kid." While the prisoners hobbled manically out of Cabanatuan and made their way across the moonlit fields toward the river, a Japanese soldier scrambled from his barracks in the rear of the camp and hid himself in a shallow ditch. Quickly, deftly, he set up a small weapon known as a knee mortar. He kicked out the prop legs and ran his fingers over the cool metal tube with the rote dexterity of one experienced in battle. He tipped the weapon toward the front of the camp, where he must have logically assumed that the greatest number of Americans would be found, pouring out the bottleneck at the main gate. Squinting in the subdued silver light, he hurriedly estimated the distance, approximately 600 yards, and roughed out his ballistics calculations accordingly. He dropped around into the muzzle and braced for the cough. Stunk! With a faint sibilance, the projectile arced high over the camp and homed toward the gate, meeting ground in a loose, ragged explosion. The soldier revised his calculation slightly and dropped in another shell, stunk, and a third. It is not unreasonable to imagine that the last feeling surging in his breast was one of pride and soldierly accomplishment, for in poor visibility, under trying circumstances, he had struck his distant target with precision. Francis Schilly, Roy Sweezy, and several others from F Company were the first men to detect the mortar. The bright muzzle flame and low pneumatic burst of the weapon unmistakably gave the soldier's position away. Schilly and the others turned to spray him with heavy automatic fire, and abruptly the mortar attack ceased. Around the front gate, at the point of impact, the mortar shells had thrown up clouds of dirt and left a triad of large divots in the road. All the Rangers and prisoners in the vicinity had hurled themselves on the ground. Now they lay shaking off the shock and fingering their wounds in the hope that they'd been hit only by rocks or soil debris, and not by the lethal shards of a mortar round. The Rangers began to suspect that the rounds had incompletely fragmented, because many men standing close to the explosions, such as Captain Prince, had been left unscathed, while a few others caught large hunks of hot shrapnel. One of the unfortunates was an Alamo scout named Alfred Alfonso. He had received a significant fragment in his lower abdomen, and he was losing much blood. A medic ran over to give Alfonso a syringe of morphine and quickly patch him up so he could be ferried across the river. Quickly scanning the area around the front gate, Prince could see that there were a half dozen others down, and he remembered thinking how oddly random the casualties appeared. "It could have been me. It could have been anybody," Prince recalled. There was no rhyme or reason to it. Captain Prince ordered a couple of Rangers to scour the area and learn the total number of casualties. The report came back better than he had feared. Although dozens were cut or scraped, only five men needed attention. Miraculously, none of them was a prisoner, and no one seemed to be critically injured. But then a sixth casualty was found. He'd been hard to spot because he was lying down in the roadside ditch and capable of only feeble speech. "Where you hit?" asked John Nelson, one of the medics. "Stomach." The wound was bleeding profusely, warm rivulets spilling through his fingers. Nelson couldn't see his face in the darkness, but with the alacrity and calm haste of a seasoned medic, he began to dress the wound. "Go find Captain Fisher," Nelson said. "This man is badly hurt." The injured man lifted his arm. "I'm Captain Fisher," he said. "What?" Nelson said distractedly. "It's me. Jimmy." Nelson squinted in disbelief. Fisher and he were the best of friends. Nelson was the number one boy, as he called himself, Captain Fisher's first sergeant. Ever since New Guinea, they'd spent endless hours bullshitting with each other. They dreamed about taking a long sailing trip around America after the war was over. Now Fisher couldn't move. He lay awkwardly on his back, breathing thinly, the color flushing from his face. The blast from one of the mortar shells had hurled him into the ditch. Fisher knew it was extremely serious. He grimaced and bit his lip. His pulse was thready. The wound was large and jagged, the blood hemorrhaging with his heartbeat. Embedded in his viscera, the shrapnel was hot and serrated, a sharp pressure against the wall of his abdomen. It pained him to draw breath, as though the shard were biting a little deeper into him each time he inhaled. He wasn't positive, but he thought the fragment had struck his liver. As he faded in and out of consciousness, a team of medics moved in fast with a litter to carry their fallen doctor across the Pampanga River toward Platero. When the long straggle of inmates left their blazing prison behind and tore out, many of them barefoot, across the stubbled fields, their spirits soared with an optimism they hadn't known in years. The stunned disbelief they had initially felt had given way to a guarded giddiness that seeped down to their feet and kept them moving at a spry clip. To watch Cabanatuan consumed by fire was unimaginably cathartic for them. "I turned back toward camp once more to see flames leaping skyward," Dr. Hibbs wrote. "For the first time, I was finally convinced that we were honest to God going to make it." 100 yards out, the escaping prisoners were met by the radiant countenance of Henry Musi. The colonel had spent the opening moments of the raid crouched in the rice fields, carefully watching the fireworks go off. Now he rose up and made his considerable presence felt. Musi projected just the sort of steady confidence and air of authority that the skittish prisoners needed as they emerged into the world. He came across as his usual stentorian self, offering bright words of praise and encouragement, taking the more tentative prisoners by the hand, doubling back again and again to greet each fresh wave of the newly freed inmates. Unaware that Captain Fisher had been hit by a mortar shell fragment, Musi was unequivocally ecstatic about the raid.
"Everything went off exactly as we planned," he said, "by luck and by the grace of God."
Musi was thrilled by the generosity and game spirit he saw in his rangers.
"Some of them gave their shoes and most of their clothes to the prisoners who needed them," the colonel later fondly recalled. "They gave the prisoners cigarettes and held them up when they needed it. I cannot say too much for them."
Yet as they made their way over the rice fields, the faltering chatter of gunfire in and around the compound was soon engulfed by another, even more terrifying ruckus. Less than a mile to the northeast, at the Kabu River Bridge, an enormous firefight had erupted between Captain Pahota's men and the Japanese troops camped along the Kabu. As they hopped and limped due north toward Platero, the prisoners could hear the deafening roar and see the riverbed coruscating with gunfire and explosions. Stray Japanese slugs streaked across the field and riddled the dirt around them. As one ranger recalled, "Those bullets were singing a pretty tune over our heads." The prisoners and rangers zigzagged their way across the paddies to avoid getting hit. For a half hour, the ungainly procession of the halt and the blind worked its way north. As they plodded along, Musi kept darting nervous glances off to the right, where the fighting at the Kabu Bridge continued to rage with undiminished ferocity. The Imperial Army soldiers were still obviously trying to break through and come after them. Musi couldn't quite make out what was happening over there. Pahota appeared to be putting up a good fight, but it remained to be seen whether he could hold long enough for all the prisoners to cross over to the other side of the Pampanga. Finally, Musi led the men down to the banks of the river, where he rejoiced to learn that Pahota's lieutenants had made good on their promise. In the bright moonlight, Musi could clearly see a dozen Carabao carts parked down in the riverbed, the great yoked beasts stamping along the muddy margins. They were unlikely Karens, encrusted in slop, reeking of various wet, musky odors, their massive horns bobbing in the darkness. Their presence was a testament of local loyalty to Pahota as well as to the Americans. A peasant of Nueva Ecija didn't lightly offer up his carabao, the bulwark of his livelihood, to anyone. Pahota's men had to fan out in all directions, locating animals and wagons from faraway villages. Yet as remarkable as this fleet of beasts of burden was to behold, The colonel could already see that a dozen carts weren't enough. The condition of the prisoners was much worse than he had expected. Before the night was through, Pahota's minions would have to return to the countryside and scare up a few dozen more of these quixotic conveyances. To some, the Pampanga was both a literal and a metaphorical line of demarcation. Crossing it was to cross over into freedom, for many prisoners doubted that the Japanese would elect to give further chase beyond the river. One POW thought the train of prisoners approaching the banks of the Pampanga looked like the Hebrews of Exodus, waiting for the Red Sea to part before Pharaoh's warriors arrived in hot pursuit. The most incapacitated prisoners were brought over to the ox carts and placed inside the straw-lined beds, five to a wagon. Using pliable cane poles, the drivers, who in most cases were the actual owners, prodded their animals across the river. One of the ox carts tipped over into the water, and a group of men had to struggle to right it. Although it was swift, the river was shallow enough so that the water came up only to the axles of the wagon wheels. With maddening slowness, but without a hint of physical strain, the carabao tugged their cargo across the channel, the creaky wagons heaving behind them.